Welcome to Discovery 2, Module 6. We're going to do a little bit of revision today, and we're going to revise a couple of key concepts. And then once this lecture's out of the way, I can get back to working on the remote bundle, the new improved remote bundle that students can do their labs on. Alrighty, can anybody give me one of the three types of connections you can have to your ISP? There are three main types. Anybody remember?
Cable.
Not quite. That is a type of connection, but I'm looking at the three types of the broad types of connections you can have. Okay, so the three types of connections, we've got point to point. So you've got one connection from your ISP to your customer. Example T1 or E1. You've got a switch circuit, which is your ISDN or your modem. In other words, you establish a circuit, you use that circuit, you shut it down. So, and then you're looking at packet switched, for example, frame relay, which cable would also fall into. Okay, can anybody tell me what... does anybody know the difference between analog and digital bandwidth?
Analog is waves and digital zeros and ones.
That is true. And do you know the measurement units for either one of them? One of the two? That's right.
Kilohertz for for analog, and kilobytes for the digital realm.
Actually, to be technical, it's hertz for
hertz. Yes, all right. Let's be technical. Yep. Hertz for analog and
bits per second.
Per second for your digital. Yes.
I thought it was hertz for the analog, but wasn't sure which megahertz, kilohertz.
Just hertz. You always use the base unit. So, interestingly enough, in the metric system, the base unit is actually a meter. And all of the other units are actually subclasses of that. So a centimeter or a millimeter or a micrometer are actually subdivisions of the meter. Whereas if you're using the imperial system, it's all just wrong. And you've got inches and you've got feet and you've got yards and you've got miles. You don't actually use subdivisions of the actual measurements like you do in metric. So there are 100 centimetres in a metre, and there are 1,000 millimetres in a metre, which is what milli means. It means 1,000. Now, interestingly enough, and I'm just going to go over this again because it's important, remember, in data communications, a megabit has how many bits?
1 million.
Yep. So, we are using the term kilobit to have 1,000 bits, and we are using the term megabit to have 1 million bits, and we are using the term gigabit to have 1 gigabit. We are not using kibi, mibi, or gibi, because a gibi bit has 2 to the power of whatever it is, 32? Yeah, I think it is. But yeah, they're the binary ones. So if you've got a kibi bit, that has 1,024, and that's the difference between the units, although most people don't say it because everybody else laughs and it sounds funny, but there are actually ISO standard units for the 2 to the power of measures. So 2 to the power of 10 is 1,024, which is a kibi bit. As we remember, the binary powers of 2 units are used when measuring the space in memory, so computer memory, for example. So a megabyte or a MIBI byte of computer memory is 1,048,576. However, note that drive manufacturers use a gigabyte as 1 billion bytes. So your 320 gig drive is only 307,000 and something megabytes in the binary form. And just a reminder that Windows gives you measurements in the binary forms, not the drive gigabytes sizes, which is why it always looks smaller under Windows than
which
it does
on... Which is why you think you might
the...
be cheated out of a bit of disk space, when you're actually not.
I had this irate Pommy guy jumping up and down telling me that he'd bought this 540 meg hard drive, and why did it only have 504 megs on it, and he was taking it back to the shop. He was adamant.
It's because one issue is binary.
Yeah, pretty much. So there you go. So there are your bandwidth measurements, and it's important. It really is important, and I don't have the energy to be putting mega underlines and stuff under things today, but assume they're there. Big, screaming, fluoro-orange, italics letters that leap themselves so far through the page that they stab you in the eyeballs. This is important, that you understand these bandwidth concepts, because when you are selling people something, and you're going to sell them a particular bandwidth, and you're going to sell them a particular speed at a particular price, you need to be able to answer their questions such as, so, how fast can I expect my downloads to go on this speed link? Now, for example, and here's a rough example, approximately what speed can you expect out of a 256 kilobit link? Does anybody know? Theoretical maximum. In the...
Isn't it 15K?
No, but guess.
Around about 32K, I think, a sec, isn't it? Theoretical.
Theoretical maximum is 32K a second, but does anybody know what the real-world performance is generally?
About 25K a sec.
That's exactly right. But, well, I've actually seen 26.4. But 25 is about what it swings around at.
It's usually because of the overheads and stuff, isn't it?
Oh, my wordy, yes.
Oh, Kerry will keep you busy with that one.
That's not that difficult, actually. I will show you. Sorry, Saprita?
I suppose it's 1 by 8 of 256, I suppose.
Yes, it is. There are 8 bits in a byte. And you multiply, you divide 256,000 bits per second divided by 8, and you get 32 kilobytes a second, theoretical maximum. You're exactly correct. Well done. It's basically, and we did do this, we touched on this in Discovery 1, but it's not really well handled, if I remember correctly.
No, it's... That sort of stuff was handled differently in the old CCNA course.
I think it was handled a lot better, but don't get me started. It's a units per time sort of thing. So let's say, for example, we take the example of miles per hour, okay? Just because we're going to be imperial today. How far does a car travel? How long does it take a car to travel 60 miles if it's travelling at 60 miles per hour?
1 hour.
All right. How long does it take? How far will the car go in 2 hours?
120.
Yeah, exactly. If a computer is transferring 32 kilobytes a second, how many kilobytes will be transferred in 2 seconds?
64.
That's correct. Okay. So, what you need to do is, if you're doing these calculations to figure out how fast things are going, make sure your units are making sense. So, if your bandwidth is measured in bits per second, okay, convert your file size into bits by multiplying the file size by 8, and then do your divisions, because you cannot divide and convert different units. Okay, it's very difficult, it's very difficult to compare differing unit sizes. So you've got to have everything in the same units before you do the division. And in the CCNA course, we actually did an exercise where you actually divide, you actually calculate how long it's going to take to receive a file over various bandwidth links. And sadly, that exercise has gone from Discovery. We can make it come back, though. I have it in my CCNA 1 folder. In fact, we might make it come back. We'll see how we go. But there's actually a set of exercises where you calculate how long it's going to take. And interestingly enough, has anybody ever noticed, well, I'm very surprised if anybody hasn't, has anybody ever noticed how the upload and download speed swings around in Internet Explorer all over the shop?
Yeah. Yeah.
Does anybody know why?
Yeah, it's because it's averaging it out.
That is correct. It's averaging it out over the over the total time of the transfer. So, if you've got two downloads going at once, for example, and say each of them is getting 30k a second on each download, which doesn't usually work out that way for reasons that I'm not going into here, when the other download stops, because it's actually an average, it actually takes time for the transfer speed to climb back up to full speed because it's actually averaged over the whole time of the download. So the trick is, of course, when you do things like speed tests and stuff, you need to average out the speed over a certain period of time. So if you're pulling down, usually when you do a speed test on an ADSL connection, you pull down a 10 meg file, and it averages it over the time taken for the whole file to come down. And the reason they do that is to get an idea of, and as we know, the internet goes at different speeds at different times, but it gives you an overall average idea of how fast things are going. And this is important when you're actually picking links for companies and stuff, because you need to know how the link is going to perform under the sort of traffic they're going to throw over it. The reality is that whilst you can certainly sell them the most expensive link you've got to keep people happy with the service that you're selling them, otherwise they'll go somewhere else. So you have to look at things like quality of service and how well the links performs and how well the links don't perform. Any questions on that from anyone?
Not really.
Oh, righty.
That's just common sense to me.
Yeah, well, you'd think so, but you'd think so, but it's not as simple as it seems. The back door's
not unlocked. I suppose what you've got to do is, I've told you about resources and links for companies, you've got to sort of find out whether that company plans to change their sort of method of operation and plans to expand and try and build some redundancy into the system for them if that's what you think they need.
You can certainly do that, but often the choices of links and stuff that you're picking and stuff is governed by the technology that you have at the time,
and the budget.
And the budget. So it depends. I mean, I don't know whether you remember, but back in say 1995, before we had the explosion of ADSL over here in Australia, your choices were, generally speaking, dial-up modem with a maximum of 56 kilobits per second downstream or whatever, although that stuff didn't stabilise till 97, if memory serves. We had K56 Flex
When it was 36.6 and then about 95 or 28.8 or whatever it was there.
Yeah, well, yeah, you had two competing standards. You had VFC and you had V34, but they were trying to merge them into the two standards to get the V.34. But you had K56 Flex and you have X.2, which were the two standards that were out there. One was the US Robotics one and the other one was the Rockwell one, and they ended up merging those together. But the point of all of that was your choices were dial-up modem or ISDN. And I believe that the price for an ISDN connection, when we looked at it in 1999 through Telstra, which obviously is one of our more expensive providers, but nobody else really had the service, was $990 a month for a full-time 64K ISDN, unlimited bandwidth.
Yeah, it's pretty steep, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Or you could get a dial-up connection for $22 a month for 100 meg, plus each of your megabytes billed at 19.2 cents a megabyte.
Oh, how times have changed. Certainly get a bit more bang for your dollar now.
That's interesting. The fact is, though, in Australia, we are still bandwidth metered and we are still bandwidth limited, and all of these all-you-can-eat plans basically have limits on how much you can pull down. It's all-you-can-eat except for if this happens or except for if that happens. And I don't believe in my... that I know of any unlimited plans in Australia, except for those that run at 256 or 512 kilobits, where you're actually limited by how much you can download in a month anyway by the pure physics of the connection.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that, because I've been looking around at different plans over the last few months for different people I know. Most of the what we would consider as broadband, let's say, the ADSL connections have got some sort of, you know, so many gigs off peak and so many gigs on peak, et cetera, et cetera.
And that's not really convenient for a lot of people to work in the off-peak times. I mean, sure, you've got people who've got download managers and stuff and know how to set them up so that all the downloads can start after midnight. But sometimes those things aren't possible. And I know, for example... and I don't know whether you've looked at it, at least the MuTorrent scheduler is effectively inaccessible with JAWS.
No, I haven't, but I'm actually looking at something for RTorrent under Linux. Well, Craig and I meant to be doing it. But, yeah, so it's just on the to-do list, so to speak. I believe it's there, but we just haven't had a chance to look at it yet. And as for the MuTorrent one, yeah, so it's a great program, but I only use it periodically these days.
As far as I recollect, they've added DHT to transmission, so that might be worth a look as well.
Do it our torrent on MuTorrent.
No, I'm talking about transmission. There's a torrent client called Transmission that runs from the command line, so he'd like it.
Oh, right.
And they've got DHT in it now.
DHT?
The dynamic hash check stuff that lets trackerless torrents.
Yep. Oh, cool. Mention it.
All right, back to the lectures. Although some of this auxiliary stuff is somewhat useful.
Well, it is, because, you know, a lot of off-peak rates now are starting not so much at midnight, they're starting at 2 and 3 in the morning now.
Yeah, and not all of us want to set an alarm clock for 2 or 3 in the morning and jump up at 2 or 3 in the morning to...
Quite.
There we go. Who's... Oh, there we go. Has Kieran just come back, has he? Or? Yeah, you're right. No, you're right. I'll come down and chase you if I need to find you. Okay, the other thing you're going to have to do is you're going to have to talk about the IP addresses that you want to give customers. How many IPs do they need, and how many IP addresses do they want? Can anybody give me a valid reason why you would want more than one IP address at a company or a customer site?
Perhaps if they're running services like a mail server and or web service, and they wanted, for some reason... they wanted those different services to operate on different IP addresses. Maybe they were chaining different domain names to it and they weren't running name-based domains. Who knows?
That's certainly a very good reason. Also, what if you want some sort of redundancy? You want multiple web servers and you want to load balance across the two web servers. You want to actually use both servers to serve out content.
Yep, that's fair enough. Like database on one server and the actual guts of the website on another, etc.
Or they may actually have... because it does actually... obviously we don't see a lot of high-volume stuff like this, but sometimes we actually see a case where name-based virtual hosting, whilst it works very well, doesn't support browsers that won't support JavaScript. Is it JavaScript? Yes, it is JavaScript, I think. No, it doesn't support the ones that won't send the host header, which is pretty ancient stuff, but there are some set-top boxes that don't do that, which is a bit silly. And also, people... it does actually incur a performance penalty on the web server to actually do that host header processing. And if you're dealing with high levels of traffic, that can actually make a difference, although you'd have to be at pretty high levels for it to make a difference, but it can actually impact on the web server.
Yep.
The other reason you might want more than one IP addresses is if you have more than one server providing services on the same port, so as you say, more than one web server, also more than one VoIP device. Say, for example, you want a whole stack of VoIP devices listening on different IP addresses at port 5060, you might actually want more than one IP address for that.
Yep, it sort of makes sense.
Although given the price of IP... the other reason you'd want them is if you had multiple servers that needed to be accessible by VPN. You'd want more than one IP. Alrighty. Now, we talked last week about how the clock rate is set by the ISP and CSU and DSU. CSU being customer, being the... And we're talking about the clock rate set on the CSU, because C is for clock rate. Okay, we talked basically about the Cisco ports, and we talked about sticky MAC addresses, that where the switch learns what MAC address is on a particular port. And if you plug one computer in to that port, it will learn the MAC address on that port. And then if you plug another computer into that same port, it will actually cause a security violation and lock it out. So ironically enough, that's when it's critically important to know which port you've plugged your computer in, otherwise you'll see a security lockout. That's important in places like universities and colleges, because you can bet your bottom dollar that if there is a network port on the wall, that some student or hacker type is going to plug their laptop into it and see what happens. And if your DHCP server is gratuitously handing out IP addresses, they will get free internet access.
An IP address.
I actually heard a story of a friend of mine who was in Germany, and he basically sat in front of a government building using their open wireless access point that was in the building, and was ripping down stuff down off the internet at 5 megabytes a second.
Well, there you go. I know it's illegal, but really, they should have bolted their connection down.
Well, the interesting thing is, and we won't talk about this for too long, but I'm amazed at how many people take the attitude, well, if your wireless is open, suck eggs, and they just steal it no matter what. They just go, well, if you're too stupid to have it open, I'm just going to take it.
Oh, I know a guy in England who... not only was the network open, but the default password and username was still left as it was on the router, so he logged in and changed the SSID to Free Internet for All.
Yeah, not a particularly nice thing to do, but it may have turned.
We don't condone that, but there he is.
No. Yeah, I think the other... we actually know somebody who packs up a Yagi, which is a high-gain antenna, and he folds it all up and puts it in his bag and takes it travelling for the explicit thing that he can sit in his motel and spy out about 10 wireless networks, and about 3 of the 10 will be open, and that does his internet access. So there's always a few people willing to
let you have their internet.
Okay, I'm just doing a scrolling down deal here. So has anybody got any questions on any of that? And that's all right, I know you don't have any, Grace, because you were off taking care of something and missed the section on, I can't remember what I was raving about back up there, but yeah, missed that section as well. Multiple IP addresses and how many IP addresses you give the customer, that's right. Okay, the other thing that they suggest here is you disable any unused ports. In other words, if a port has nothing connected into it, shut it down. It's a standard security measure so that people do not take advantage of this sort of stuff. Now, what you'll tend to find is on most home switches, they're basically idiot boxes. They have no intelligence. Every port acts the same, except, of course, for those switches that have got that weird port on the end that happens to be marked uplink, and the book says that you can only have something in port 7 or 8, because 8 or 9, because 8 is the uplink, and 9 is the uplink, and 8 is the switch port. And, of course, everybody gets 8 devices, and they connect them all in, and then they try and connect something into the uplink port, and they find that it doesn't work. Now, can anybody suggest, does anybody have any concept of why you can only use port 8 or 9 on those particular switches? You can't use both. And I don't expect anybody to necessarily know, because maybe they don't think about these things as much as I do, and maybe I need to get myself a life. But yeah, anybody got any idea as to why you can only use port 8 or 9? The reason is that port 8 and 9 are actually wired into the same switch port. The only difference between port 8 and 9 is that the received pair and the send pair are crossed over on port 9 to what they are on port 8. So you only still have an 8-port switch. It just so happens that the 9th port is wired in parallel with the pairs crossed over.
Okay. So, why did they do it like that instead of making them separate?
Because you've only got an 8-port switch, and there used to be, before we had auto-negotiation, to actually uplink two switches together, there was two ways of doing it. One was to connect a crossover cable between the two switches, which would cross the received and send pairs, so 1 and 2 would meet 3 and 6, 3 and 6 would meet 1 and 2. The other way was to run a straight-through cable between an uplink port and a regular port. And the reason you did it that way is so your network could have all straight-through cables rather than having a mismatch of straight-through and crossover cables. The only reason I talk about all of this stuff, and you're all going to tell me, but I don't have to worry about that anymore because we've all got N-way auto-negotiation, and my switch automatically switches the pairs over, and not to mention my laptop automatically switches the pairs over, so I just plug it in and it all goes. Well, when you go out to some crusty Western Australian business that's got switches from 1998 and something's not working, you'll have flashbacks to this lecture and go, I remember him going on about this. And in fact, all of the auto pair crossover stuff is absolutely brilliant, and I use it on a regular basis, and it all works beautifully, except for the times when it doesn't. And then you have to go in and turn it off and get the right cables and all that sort of good stuff. And I have actually seen, and I don't know whether you've seen this, Elise, as well, sometimes, and it's pretty rare, luckily, there are certain network cards and cables that don't like certain switches, and you connect the two together and things just don't work. And swapping out the NIC or getting a different switch just makes the whole thing work.
Oh, yeah, occasionally, not so often, but I've heard of it happening.
We have some interesting... battles with that. Okay. I was just trying to curse it down in the wrong window. That's really good.
I'll catch you all later, folks.
See ya.
Okay, Leon. Okay. Now, the CDP is the Cisco Discovery Protocol. It is a protocol that works at layer 2, which means it works below all of the protocol layers, such as TCP/IP, IPX, SPX, all that sort of stuff. So it works if an interface is up, regardless or not, as to whether IP addresses and stuff are configured on the interface. This is kind of handy because it can help map out your network and show you which routers are where. It's enabled when the routers are booted up. Most people turn it off for security reasons, for reasons that I'll talk about in a minute. It collects information on directly connected networks. So it tells you what the networks that are directly connected to you are, what sort of routers they're running, and what the configuration of those routers are. Two devices that are directly connected are neighbors, and that's very important if you're showing the neighbor table on the CDP router. The info you can get from CDP includes the device identifiers, the configured host name, the address lists for layer 3 addresses if you've got them configured, such as IP addresses, subnet masks, port identifiers, for example fast ethernet 0/0, and the capabilities list, as in the functions provided by the device, such as whether it's a bridge, a router, a switch. The hardware platform of the device, for example, Cisco 1841. Can anybody tell me why this might be a problem if you leave it enabled on production networks? Basically, it's information leakage. If you've got these CDP packets being broadcasted all over the network containing all sorts of information about your routes and your router platforms and your iOS versions and all this sort of stuff, all an attacker needs to do is to sniff off the CDP packets, look up a script kiddie database of router exploits, and find out that you're running iOS 11.2.3 on an 1841 that has the wibble wibble bug, and they can hack into your network. And there are security things that do come up in iOS from time to time that do allow people to hack in. So two things. One is don't give people any more information than you absolutely need to. And secondly, keep your iOS images up to date with all of the necessary security fixes. It's like any sort of computing device. You must keep things up to date, otherwise people will exploit security flaws.
Fair enough.
Alrighty. Any questions on any of that? Because we're just about to go on to routing. All right. This is officially the start of Chapter 6, but we'll start the rest of it in Chapter 6 anyway, so that the other revision-y bits that we just did will go in the Chapter 6 lecture, because that's probably worth doing. Okay, it might be necessary to break large subnets into smaller subnets for administrative reasons. Now, a lot of this should be revision to a lot of people. Okay, routers have different networks on different interfaces, and the router routes between them. Can anybody define for me what an interface is on a particular device?
Is it like my Linksys router, where one interface was the BG and one interface was the N network?
That's one definition of an interface. Can anybody come up with a less specific definition of an interface? Anybody have a less specific definition of an interface? That's a good one. That does say what one of the things the interface does, but does anybody have an idea on a less specific definition? An interface is a device that sends or receives packets on a network. So a network interface card is the device that sends or receives packets on the network for your computer. And as Grace said, she has two separate radios that were a B and a G radio, and she had an N radio. The interesting thing, though, is that they probably sent and received information on the same IP subnet, and they probably shared the same IP subnet space. So from a layer 2 perspective, they were separate interfaces, but from a layer 3 perspective, they were actually communicating on the same network, so the two interfaces were actually bridged together. So if you associated onto the N network, you'd still get an IP range in 192.168.2. whatever, or whatever the range was. I can't remember. It was in one of the worksheets last term. But if you associated with the BG, if you associated with the BGN section, you'd get one in 192.168.2.x. And if you associated with the A section, you would get something in 192.168.2.x. So in fact, the router only, it had two physical interfaces, but it only had one logical interface, because they were both bridged together. Okay, so let's take the definition of, say, an integrated services router, and we'll take the example of, say, either a cable modem or an ADSL modem. Generally speaking, can anybody tell me how many interfaces are generally on these devices, and we'll assume that it has no wireless?
One.
Nope.
2?
Yes. With the integrated services router, if it was an ADSL modem, you'd be absolutely correct, Grace. There is one interface. And that would be the one, I don't know whether anybody's ever seen the one-port ADSL modems that just basically assign the external IP addresses directly to the single computer that's connected to them. And then you enable ADSL internet connection sharing, and then you basically get sick of it in a week and go out and buy a real router. but they have two interfaces. One is the ADSL, and the other one is the internal stuff that connects to your network, so two network interfaces. Remember that the web management address of the router is usually on your internal network, and it's usually located on .1 or .254 or one of those special addresses that's written in the book. And you can actually connect to that, and to be actually able to administer the router over the internet, which isn't usually a particularly good idea, you can actually enable remote access, which will then bring that up on the other interface. So two interfaces on your regular internet services router. Anybody else tell me what's usually part of an integrated services router, as well as the two network interfaces?
Wireless access point?
Can be, yes.
DHCP server.
Yep, another networky component that's usually a part of them. Well, there are two of them, actually.
Another network component. Switch!
Yes, a switch! I was about to say London is falling down, and some of them often have a bridge. A switch is a multi-port bridge. So what you generally have in these devices is you have the ADSL out on its own setup, and it sort of talks to itself. You then have the network address translation logic that sits in the middle that handles all of your network address translation. You then have a switch, and connected to that switch you have a number of Ethernet ports, and you can then have one or more wireless access points connected onto various ports of that switch. Now the other thing to keep in mind is that most home routers also have a router in them, and the router is what's responsible for routing information between the two interfaces, so it takes care of if Grace and I are sitting on a 4-port USB modem, 4-port ADSL modem. I've obviously gone broke in the interim because I've obviously downsized my network, and her computer wants to send information to my computer. It then goes through the switch, and it does not traverse the ADSL, therefore it remains on the local subnet. If, however, we want to talk to Elise on Skype, we would then send a packet to the router, which would then route it out onto the external internet at large. Okie dokie. Now, for a router to be able to handle the task of routing, it needs what we call a routing table. So what I want everybody to do is, if they can, is to open their command prompt, which is Windows R and CMD. And then I want people to execute route space print. And I'll just give everybody a few seconds to do that. And what you will find is that there are all sorts of routes in your routing table that show at where to send packets. And with Windows, there's some multitask routes, there's one for your broadcast route. There's a whole stack for VMware if you've got that installed. I've got a whole lot for 192.168.100. And that is a routing table. Now, there are two different places that routes can point at. A route can point at a default gateway. Or a route can point at a gateway, I should say. Okay, it can point to gateways, which is another machine on the network that will handle the traffic, or the route can point to an interface. A route can point to an interface or a gateway. An interface or a gateway. This is really important. A route can only either point to an interface or a gateway. Now, if the route is pointing to a gateway, it needs to the gateway has to have an IP address on the same network as the router. Anybody know why?
It can't reach it if it doesn't.
Sorry, Kira, could you just repeat that?
I just said, does anybody know why the router's gateway has to be on the same subnet as the router?
It's not going to send stuff out past it if it isn't.
That's right. But everybody does it, and they all wonder why their default route works. That doesn't work because the router can't actually reach the gateway because it's on a different subnet. Okie dokie, the routing table has more four main parts, and you will get to see these when you get to go through the labs in Discovery 2, and you can actually use the Curtin remote bundle to do a lot of those labs. There is a labs that can or cannot be done document, so I'd encourage students to hook in and do the labs that can be done on the remote Curtin bundle, and then we'll come back and do the labs that cannot be done. The destination value, which is where the route is going to, either an interface or a gateway. The subnet mask, which we've pretty much flogged to death. The gateway or the interface address.
Mm-hmm, yeah, those four columns.
And the route cost. We're not sure. Does Windows have a four column? Yes, it is.
Windows has 5 columns.
Yes, yes, that's because...
The last one being...
Yes, that's because they put the interface name and the interface and the address on that interface that the stuff is going to travel out through. I think that's why they've got the fifth column.
Mm-hmm.
The router examines the destination address to route packets. It examines the destination address to route packets. This is really important. It examines the destination address of the packet to route them, whatever. I suppose if you get the destination wrong, it does route them. essentially, it exempts a destination address. Now, a lot of people get this confused. And in fact, in a lot of home situations, a lot of people sort of say, but if it's coming from this PC, I want it to do that. And if it's coming from that PC, I want to do it from that. And if it's coming from the other PC, I want it to do this. That is not routing. That is what we call policy routing or firewalling. And routers work on the destination address of the packets. It also looks at the subnet mask, which is set on the destination route. It basically ANDs the address you've got with the destination mask and then decides whether the packet is on the network for that particular route before it decides whether it actually sends it over that network. If you've got multiple matches, it uses the one with the longest subnet prefix. In other words, whether there's 10 or 20 bits or whatever that are valid, it actually uses the longest one. And that is something that we will cover when you actually set up routing protocols. If there are no specific routes that match your destination of your packets, it sends it to the default gateway, or it drops the packet. So say, for example, we have a network of 192.168.100.0 with a subnet mask of /24 or 255.255.255.0. Where will the packet for 192.168.57.8 be sent to?
That'll go to the default gateway.
It will, in fact, go to the default gateway. And what if there is no default gateway?
Wouldn't there have to be?
What if there isn't? Because the person that you just hired, the person you have in on work experience is setting up the network, and they didn't put in the default gateway.
It's gone.
The packet might be lost.
The packet will be lost. And does anybody know what message you get back from ICMP if that happens? Anybody have any idea?
Jeez, I've probably seen it. No route found or no route found or something? Something words to that effect?
You will usually get either a no route to host or network is unreachable.
Ah, yes, I've seen that.
Absolutely, and you'll often see network unreachable and stuff on traceroute messages and stuff if you're traceroute to things and people have got things broken and the packets can't get there. Now, the other thing that is worth mentioning, and this is something that sounds pretty obvious, but people just make a mess of it. If you've got a route for packets to get somewhere, you've also got to have a route for the packets to come back by. I don't know how many people think they can turn off their network address translation and then use their 192.168.1 dot whatever addresses on the internet and just send packets, because, well, you're on 192.168.1 and I'm on 192.168.2, so we should be able to just send packets backwards and forwards over the internet. No, because the ISP doesn't know what you're doing and it can't send the packets back the other way. Okay, on Cisco equipment, you can do a show IP route command. And it actually shows up the different routes with different symbols. So, for example, C means they're directly connected. These are routes to directly connected interfaces on the router, so fast Ethernet 0/0, fast Ethernet 1/0, etc. The static routes, which are stuck in by the network administrator, they are marked with an S. And the dynamic routes are put in with a routing protocol, such as Routing Information Protocol or RIP. And they're marked with R. Okay, now the routes only go to the next hop. Only at the end of the routing chain do they actually point to a specific host or a specific place. So you only route to the machines that you know about that are closest to you. And this is important if you're setting up intranets and you've got multiple Cisco routers. You route to the next router. You don't try and fire packets across to the one that's six routers away or six hops away. You can add static routes in the privileged exec mode, and obviously you need to know what you're doing because static routes override routes that are learnt by routing protocols. And as I said, you must also configure a route back on the other routers, otherwise the packets will not return. That is the end of the lecture. Any questions? Has anybody noticed, by the way, that I've moved the updated Accessing the Remote Bundle document into the Discovery 2 area for you all to look at?
No, but I remember you saying you were going to.
I did.
You're great.
Oh, I wouldn't say that, but I did actually get to moving that document, and it is actually in the lab manual section, updated Accessing the Remote Bundle.
Did you sim link it or physically move it?
I actually copied it. It's not a big document.
Yeah, I copied it. Yeah. So it's in both areas.
Yes, it is. I'm not 100% sure whether our Apache is set to follow symlinks, and given the fact that we're migrating the whole web server website across onto a new server, we're going to fix the initial breakage, and then we're going to see what still works after that before we look at whether various...
Another new server.